Hello everyone and welcome to episode 20 of Design Truth. If you are new around here, my name is Brad Harper and I am an industrial design recruiter. The aim of Design Truth is to keep industrial design connected. So me and Drew, who is an actual designer, have a beer, hit record and rope on some guests. So today we've got Jim Blythe and Matt Plested from The Fuel, two incredibly highly respected designers over here in the UK, and if you don't know who they are, then you know, I question where you've been. I'll let them introduce themselves shortly, but if you do like the podcast, if you do like Design Truth, then share it with a mate or maybe even a potential sponsor. Drew is a Liverpool fan, so maybe something like that would cheer him up. I don't know, but as always, thank you for listening. So I suppose welcome is probably the first thing I should say to
everyone.
To Jim and Matt.
Thank you. Thanks.
To people that are listening, we actually caught up as a foursome last week, and it was one of those where we probably could have recorded it there and then, where it was a quick impromptu 5-minute conversation to see if everyone's audio worked all right. And all of a sudden, an hour later, we're still kind of putting the world to right. So because of that, I've not really planned much for this one, because I just know it's going to be one of those conversations where you don't need to plan an awful lot and we'll just end up chatting. But I'm going to guess most people know who you are in the UK, but for those that don't, if you could just introduce yourself to the masses, that would be...
Sure, Jim, do you want to go first? Yeah, by all means. So I'm Jim Blythe, founder and partner of The Fuel with Matt. Background is... ID, graduated from Northumbria University many, many years ago, back in 99. Had a career working in ID, worked at Alloy, my previous company, for many, many years. And then back in 2018, Matt and I, who I've worked with Matt since 99, actually, so over 20 years, Matt and I formed The Fuel, and that's kind of where we are right now.
So, likewise, Matt Plested, basically, yes, a founder and director of The Fuel. Like Jim, I've been doing this game for a long time. So, actually, I graduated in 1996, which seems unbelievable now, such a long time ago, from Bournemouth Uni, which I know is Drew's uni. And so, basically, I've been in consultancy for most of my life. So, I worked in about four different consultancies. I also had a year at Dyson, which was quite interesting, quite contrasting. We might talk about that later. And then did a sort of second stint back in consultancy for various reasons. And then I was about 10 years later and got to 2018 and decided to basically start The Fuel with Jim.
Good stuff. And you forgot to mention your TV career as well.
Yeah, my career in industrial design started with TV, actually. I don't know if many people remember, but we did what was the trend at the time, actually? In the 1990s, basically, especially the late 90s, early 2000s, Fly on the Wall documentaries were the trend, and they were kind of like clambering to find whatever content they could. And somebody just stumbled on this idea of, why don't we follow loads of graduate designers and see what happens? Mm. So, yes, I basically did a programme with the BBC called Making It. It's myself and a guy called Darren Mullen, who Jim knows well, actually, from his uni days as well. And, we had a lot of pressure, is what I'm going to say, Brad. So we we started our second jobs. And within the first month or two, we were told, the BBC want to do this programme with you. However, you need to do this. It's going to take tons of your time, but your day-to-day job doesn't change. Your deadlines don't change. The workload doesn't change. However, these guys are going to basically be recording here several days a week.
You're going to be caught on video forever and judged on everything you say and do.
Including having appraisals on video. Design reviews on video.
It's a bit like keeping up with the Kardashians.
It was high pressure.
That must have taken a toll, in fairness. I mean, aside from just the day-to-day, that must have been difficult to deal with.
It was very stressful, Drew. And looking back at it now, I was quite a shy person back then. Darren was very outgoing. We were very different, which the BBC, you know, like all programmes, they played very much to the personality. So, like I say, Darren was like the showman, which I think Jim will agree. And I was like...
Nothing's changed in anything of that, yeah.
The one that was, you know, this is just terrible. I hate listening to myself. Don't want to be on TV particularly, etc. And yeah, I say they really, like typical kind of TV, they really dug into that, you know. So even when like we were reviewed off of camera by our boss at the time, obviously he's digging into that and they're doing little snapshots on camera, etc. You know, maybe, you know, one of us speaking versus the other one, etc. And like you say, it was really, really stressful. And obviously at that time particularly, you're trying to prove yourself within a career which you've only just started.
When was the last time you watched it? 99 or?
No, yeah, soon after. I mean, it goes...
Is it like that every Friday night with family?
Who wants you back with your therapist?
Yeah.
I haven't shown my kids yet, which they'll probably find it fascinating. So who's this person we don't recognise, obviously. But yeah, you're right. It's been a while.
Good stuff. I think you sent me a clip, didn't you?
I did, yes. And it was where our old boss was basically referring to... to our, the name, the fuel, 20 years before the fuel existed.
So, people are going to know obviously a lot about the fuel, but I thought it would be a good place to start in the early days, as in when your careers kind of started. I'm presuming that it's when you started out, did you think that you would be where you are today, or is it one of those things where it's just over time? Right, I'm going to own an agency and that kind of thing, or is it just something that's just formed over lived experience?
Yeah, what was life like then?
So, Jim, I mean, we, as you mentioned, we've worked together for a very, very long time, and you got to imagine, you know, like over 20 years ago, we were a lot younger. So I think back then we were just about having fun, weren't we, and just basically enjoying a job we wanted to do and trying to live a young person's lifestyle, if that makes sense.
Oh, those are the days, Drew.
Yeah, I read about those.
Yeah.
I think for me, it was like, so getting a job out of uni was the biggest, you know, desperate to do. And, you know, I can't remember how many people were in our year that graduated, but it was just all about getting a job and relatively short-sighted to get a job. And then you're in a job, shit, you got to do really, really well at your job. You're on probation. You know that there's so many good, talented juniors out there that reality is you could be kicked out at any stage. So concentrate on doing a job. And then before you know it, years have passed. You've been doing what you're doing. You've got quite good at what you're doing. And then you start looking further to the future of what is it that you actually want to achieve and want to do. But you know, definitely in those early days, I think, as Matt said, it was... trying to impress to do your job, but equally there's lots and lots and lots of late nights and lots of messing around and good fun in those late nights as well. Like, so it was hard work, but definitely good fun. I think there's some embarrassing photos of us doing stupid things 20 odd years ago, that's for sure.
I did actually see a picture of you two because I was looking on... I don't know, I haven't got it on a shared screen, I won't bring it up, but I was looking on the PD&I Twitter page.
Oh, yeah.
And I found this picture. I think he was in some sort of funky hat, Matt, I think, at the time. But
kind of, I know which one. Yeah, I think... I know the image. Yeah. Was that for a Christmas party, I think?
I think it was some sort of Christmas... Must have been some sort of Christmas deer. Yeah, don't worry, I won't get it up on the screen. But
It was the theme for that was Design Wankers, I think. So there was some dubious fancy dress going on. Sorry, Matt?
Yeah, like stewardage night out, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
But is it one of those now where you probably, because you've worked together for so long, it's almost like you can't remember not working with each other? Must be a special thing to have always worked with someone and actually got on with them as well. Yeah, was it love at first sight or?
I think the thing is yeah, we always gelled. We obviously didn't know each other till we joined basically the first company at the same time, which for me was basically my third company, Alloy, and Jim was your second company, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, we just, like Jim said, we just got on straight away. Like, you know, late nights was an absolute part of the workload, right? We always work late constantly. And I think when you do that with somebody, like, it's painful, right? But like Jim said, you're doing your job, you got impressed, you know there's loads of other people who want that job. And it became the norm, didn't it, Jim, to basically work late, have loud music on, and basically just kind of have laughs, kind of after work, but you were still working. Mm. I think that really kind of gelled it for us. And then, like, we end up working together so much over time that you just end up just knowing how the other one works, kind of work off each other in terms of knowing where your strengths and weaknesses are. And it just works so well. And we never really thought about owning something together. I think, you know, we talked many times, didn't we, Jim? Like, oh, what if we did this? What if we did that? It was never a plan, was it? It was just something that we just worked well as a pair.
Yeah, I think the thing is, it's like when we first, I joined as the junior, and Matt, you'd been there, so you had more experience than I did. So kind of, I had a lot of learning from Matt, from how the company worked, CAD systems, all stuff like that. So, but with that, as Matt says, ridiculously late nights, pissing around, having fun. But then as our kind of careers developed, I think we both ended up having, although we worked in the same company and it was a relatively small company, we both worked on separate accounts. So we weren't working directly with each other for quite a while, really, were we, Matt? I can't think
of
projects that we worked on together, because we were always, in the early days, working into different seniors. So you'd have, we'd be different projects. And then as we become more senior, we had our different accounts and different clients that we worked on. Mm. And then it's kind of, as we became in our previous business, started running that business, that's when we kind of came back together to work much closer together. And as Matt said, it's like, by that stage, we both learn our strengths and weaknesses and where we wanted to be in our careers. And we both learn, well, actually, the thing that I'm not good at, you are, or not necessarily not good at, not that I want to do as much, Matt does, and vice versa. And then that's kind of developed, and we got better and better at working like that over the years. And it's worked really, really well, because we do get on tremendously well, but we can piss each other off, but know what and how to say things when we're going through work. And it's nothing. Okay, so Matt says that. He said that because he genuinely thinks that. He's not, there's no egos involved or anything like that, which is, I think, massively valuable that when we're working on those projects. If somebody criticizes one another, it's genuine because it's better for the project or the client. It's not because I like it or you like it kind of conversation.
I always think that's such an important thing with a team, and especially a partnership. And, you know, we had Julie on that I've worked with a few times for several years, a good few episodes ago. And that was one thing that I think we talked a little bit about then, was being able to be really direct and robust with one another and know that it's because, like, the relationship and the partnership and the work is super important. And that, yeah, you know, you might come away with a few bumps and scrapes every now and then, but, like, it's good for you.
Yeah.
And it can likewise be hard to go, well, I think you're really good at this, and I think I'm really good at this, and trying to phrase that in a way that isn't, can you please take your hands off, like, off that piece of work?
So would you say that, you talk quite fondly about the late nights and probably very nostalgic.
I don't know whether it's fond.
maybe it's scarred. Are they a sort of distant memory, or is that, like, is that?
Yeah, I think it is fair to say it's distant memory, Drew. I mean, that was one thing that when we set up the Fuel, that we said that basically we don't want to be a lifestyle business, but we want to basically have a life that isn't just work. And I think when you work for somebody else, particularly at a lower level in design, and I know that, Brad, you've touched on this a few times on social media, some places it is the culture. And we were brought into a culture where basically, you know, it was tough all the time. You know, the deadlines be set. It was nothing to do with you. You were basically given this piece of work, regardless whether you needed 2 weeks or 2 days. It was probably always basically, you know, less than you needed. And you needed to impress. And there'd often be reviews, and the reviews would happen at the end of a day. And it was a case of, like, okay, so basically not happy with this, not happy with that. Basically, show me some more in the morning.
Mm. Was that a sign of the time, or just the company you was working with? Or I'm just trying to think of people that are now kind of at a similar level to you were back then. Is our design consultants, is the culture still
the same to that now, would you say? Or I know lots of agencies work late, for example, but would you say it's as similar to what it was all those years ago, or not?
I think it probably is by leadership. I don't know whether Jim agrees with that in terms of, I'm sure there's not a blanket across all, and whether it's, it was all like that and it's all not like that now, or, you know, I think it's very much on, you know, who's in charge, what's the style of management. Because also it's like, you know, what are they working on? What are they up against, etc. Bear in mind, you know, if you want the work, often you have to take the constraints that come with it. So, yes, I don't think it's a straight answer, Brad. But, I mean, we know by, like you, by reputation, obviously certain businesses have it as almost part of the culture.
Mm. But did it make you a better designer, do you think? Those, is it something that you would actually, looking back, go, I'd recommend someone that's going through it now to actually work a little bit later because it's going to actually make you better at the craft or not?
I don't think it's much about the hours that you work. I think the thing that had an impact was you'd have design reviews and you'd have pretty tough design reviews where typically it would be towards the end of the day, as Matt says, and you know that if whatever you were presenting didn't go down well, that meant you were there for the evening, sort it out, solve it, get it better. Or you, what I think it taught me the best thing is how to actually articulate your work to win over that design review, to avoid having to do the late nights. So it was kind of, the late nights led to learning a skill, which was how to present your work better effectively, or how to articulate your arguments in a better way that meant you could try harder to avoid those late nights. And it was became more of a, not a battle of wills, but a careful thoughts about not just throw some work, again, back in those days, it's throw work up on the wall and pin it up and draw on it, and have better arguments for why you've done things to avoid having to do those late nights. So I think that question, it has made me better at what I do, because if it was just a case of you have a shit review, you come in tomorrow morning and sort it out, well, is there really that drive to solve? Well, I'll do it tomorrow morning, it'll be all right, don't worry about it. Whereas it was, oh, I'm meant to be going to the pub with my mates, shit, if this doesn't go down well, then I'm here all evening. So it kind of, I suppose it had a positive impact, but not because it wasn't the hours that drove the impact.
Okay, I get that.
Did either of you have sort of part-time jobs before, like while you were in school and while you were in uni or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I did do part-time jobs. When I was at uni, every holiday, summer, winter, whatever it was, I worked on Grimsby fish docks, actually, working in the factories. So grafted my arse, get the money for the year through uni and stuff like that. So that was, again, similar kind of thing. We used to start work at 5:30 in the morning, finish at, I can't remember, there were long days. So yeah, but I didn't do part-time work whilst at uni, just during the holidays.
In contrast to Jim, I basically worked in Habitat for my whole way through university. So as designery as I can get within shops, basically.
Yeah. I always wanted to work in HMV and I could never get it. I worked in a butcher's from when I was about 14. And that was, as you know, similar sort of thing, you know, up while it was dark.
Yeah.
You come home stinking of meat.
Yeah.
And with every joint in your body knackered.
Yeah.
And then, go meet your mates. Afterwards, I mean, like a little bit older than 14, but yeah, go meet your mates on a Friday night with just enough money to buy a few rounds in, and that was about it. Back at it, yeah.
So going back to what Brad was just saying about, like, what did it do for us? The other thing that I want to add to what Jim was saying is that basically, and I think we still see this today, is it made us really ruthless in our process. So back to, like, designers can waste a lot of time, right? You can waste a lot of time pursuing ideas that take you down a rabbit hole, that basically you fall in love with yourself, right? And maybe he's going off at a tangent, it's probably not quite right to the brief, etc. And when you're a junior, you make loads of those mistakes, right? You fall in love with something, and actually, like Jim says, if you can't convince the bosses why it should go forward, you've just wasted your day. Yeah, you might have loved it, you might have produced loads of material, but it's wrong. You know, move on. Yeah.
It's also it's the client's work as well, right? So you've got to try and get into the mind of what the client's going to want rather than necessarily what you think.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same. It's the same, I suppose, in the nature of the job I do. Is I might think it's a great idea, but I know the person on the other end is going to think it's crap. So why waste my day trying to convince someone when I've got little influence over that anyway? So
there's a lesson for the house cats out there as well in that, mm-hmm. because yeah, the timelines might be a bit slacker, but it's still the client's work. And if mm-hmm. let's say if marketing isn't into it, you might have all the data on why it's cool or why it isn't, but it ain't going to cut it.
They want it in orange.
Yeah, you know, if it's not something that they can message in the right way or whatever, you know, then yeah, it's go back and do it again.
Yeah, so back to that ruthlessness, like that's the thing that we carry through to today, in that basically when we work together, we can be really, really efficient and not waste time. And so then that comes into process as well, right? So why basically start elaborating on something if the idea isn't strong enough in the first place? So I think, Jim, I don't know if you agree with me, like basically that definitely has probably formed the way that we work today, to be really, really time ruthless in terms of, yeah, there is no wasting time. It is basically get this done as quick as possible, but in the best possible way to hit the best possible result.
Yeah. Does that come from kind of the agency, every hour kind of needs to be billable mentality that comes with that? Because ultimately it's the client, and so you've got to be efficient in that work, because there's deadlines to be hit, and if you don't hit the deadline, you can start having awkward conversations, can't you? And so
I don't think when you're younger, though, I don't think you realize about having every hour has to be billed. It's just about hitting your deadline and doing a good job. And you know, even
but more so now,
it's and even trying to get across into the younger teams about, just because you've got 2 weeks to do a phase of work doesn't mean you need to take that 2 weeks to do it. It's where we're here in business. And if you can get it done in half the time and get the good result, that's a win. And I don't think when you're younger, you just don't understand that. It's I've got a window of time to do the best possible thing I could do in that window of time.
But Jim, that's university, right? University says you've got 6 weeks to do this bit of project work, so you're going to take 6 weeks, right? Yeah. So when you start working, then you say it takes time, but you suddenly realise that actually, like you say, having 2 weeks doesn't mean that's exactly what you should feel.
Yeah. So one thing that I wanted to get into, and I suppose we might spend a little bit of time on this, is just setting up of the fuel.
Mm-hmm.
What was the moment, you said you've had chats over the years, like, yeah, let's do this thing. But was there a moment where you both came together and went, right, we're going to do this? What was, it a pub? Was it a back? There must be a story of,
Ruthless smiles there. I would just say, like, whatever you can share, then go ahead. And if you can't, then that's cool. I think we all
just nod and I'll go to the next question.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think as Matt says, we work together for long enough to always discuss about potentially doing something for ourselves. But where we'd worked previously, it was really successful, and we enjoyed it. It was doing a really good job. And I think Matt said it in the past. It's like, why would we leave this? It's good for what we do. But then fast forward, things happened and we left that role. And as you say, we were sat in a pub and, It was a beer garden, actually, Matt, and then I think you remember.
We're one month away, Jim. There'll be two other designers that will be. They're thinking, right, 1 month I'll get in that beer garden and I'll have a chat with a colleague and we'll put the worlds to right. So
exactly. But it was that. It was like, well, what are we going to do? And we had thoughts, and it's like, well, why not give it a go? Need to think about carefully how we do it, what we want to do, and if we're going to do this, let's not just fall into what we've done previously and try and build an agency that's a little bit more aligned to what we want to be doing. So yeah, it was, we'd had conversations previously about, oh, what if, but they were just same as two people in a studio. Usually when you're pissed off about something or something's not gone to plan or whatever it is, you have that conversation, then you move on, conversation's gone, and it's not talked about for another 6 months, 12 months, whatever it may be. Until we were sat in a beer garden and it's like, well, do we? Should we? Should we give it a go? Well, why not? What, oh, maybe it'll go, what if this happens? And then we thought, well, actually, what is it we both really want to do? And at that stage, we sat down and we thought, well, actually, we both really like doing a certain type of work. I like this aspect, you like that aspect. What don't we like in what we've been doing or what we've seen happening in the industry? And then we sat down and kind of started formulating how can we build a fuel? And at that stage, we didn't know what it was called, to kind of suit what we both want to get out of our careers doing the work we want to do. And I could go on and on for ages about what it is and why we built what we did in the way that we've done. But yeah, there was no long-term plan about, oh, we're going to start our own business at some stage.
Sorry, I was going to say, one really important thing was actually the way we approached it as well, which was that we'd spent like, you know, best part of 20 years taking design briefs and basically building out a project, right? And what we said when we started to form what we formed was that actually, why are we not designing this like it's a design project, right? Let's do customer research. Let's basically, you know, get inside the minds of our customers. Let's find out what works, what doesn't work. Where's the opportunity to be improved? You know, where can we basically change the tools that we use? And we really did try and treat it like we were designing a product.
Yeah, it was that. It was, let's not just do everything we've done before. Let's understand. I mean, and I think the question that always triggered it, wasn't it, Matt, is the amount of time you used to go to pitches. Or you still go, actually, no, we don't go to pitches anymore.
When was the last time you went to a pitch?
I can't actually remember the last time we pitched, Matt, can you?
Well, the last pitch we had was just as COVID struck this time last year, but that was the first time we'd done one where we'd never met the people.
Right.
Yeah. But it was, the question you always get asked is, what are you good at? What is it that you do? And what will you do for us? And that kind of was the leading question about what we started when we started the fuel, was trying to understand what is it we're good at? Because that's what people keep asking us. And then, well, we can sit and we can think, well, actually, we're really good at X, Y, and Z. But then that's when we went to friends, colleagues, past clients, and tried to understand from them, why is it you used us and why did you come back to us? What is it that we brought that you thought, actually, that's why I go to you people, because that's what you're good at. And that kind of focused our thoughts.
How honest were those conversations? Can you remember going to past clients and say, what did you not like about us? And then you have to brace yourself.
We were very honest, really, Brad, because we said at the time we didn't have anything, we hadn't started anything, and we were just like, honestly, just tell us whatever you want. Like, you know, you're not going to offend us. We're not selling anything. Like,
well, it's not that, because we weren't pitching anything. Right. It was, can we buy you a coffee? Can we have a pint? Whatever it may be. And quite honest, it's like, look, we're thinking about doing X, Y, and Z, but it's get people. And what I've always found, and especially in those times, when you ask people for help, people are willing to give help.
It's very surprising. I've been on a similar journey over the last, well, since we set this up, really. But if you just ask someone, like, have you got 5 minutes?
Yeah.
People genuinely will. It's when you start to sell a service, that's when people start getting a bit pissed off. But if you just say, look, I really appreciate your feedback on this, 95% of people are just quite curious. So, because they might think they've got something for themselves and think, that sounds a good idea. I remember that. But I think people would be surprised just the kinds of people you could get on those kind of conversations as well.
Yeah. And so generally, somebody will want to help you if they know you. We got a lot of home truths and a lot of honesty, but I wouldn't necessarily say there was anything that was shocking in that, what we got. It was just confirming what we thought, but it was nice to have it confirmed as opposed to your own beliefs and just thinking something might be right. So, yeah, it was, there was nothing nasty or horrible in there, but it was just confirming what we kind of convinced ourselves anyway, I suppose.
And it can be kind of reciprocal as well, because you've got to remember, some people, they're like, well, we'd love to use you more, but the reason we didn't use you was this. So if you change this, we might be able to use you some more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there, you might not be able to answer because it might, but was there anything in particular that was of like massive help to you when someone said, yeah, we didn't, like, even if it's something like, I don't know, for me, I'd probably get something like, we don't like the way you structured payment or something like that. No, it didn't suit us. And you know, we spoke about it before, Matt. It's like 30 days and you get it wrong and then you got to wait and all that kind of. Was there anything where, and you was like, oh, we're going to, we'll, it wasn't just like a confirmation. It was almost like, oh, we didn't think of that.
So there's one I can think of, which is, it's kind of obvious thing to say, but when you build relationships with clients and then a lot of our clients in the early days, you grow with those clients and your roles change and then different people come in to work with those clients.
Mm.
I think we heard from a few times, it's like, look, when we first started working with you guys, we worked directly with you guys and then we saw you less and less and less. So I think what people were trying to say there is we want to be involved with you guys because that's who we built relationships with. And what we took that to mean and what we've carried on doing is with what we've got with the fuel is we don't bring people in and then let them work on the clients and us disappear out of sight. Mm. So it was those kind of comments from people about, well, actually, I think they did say the words, we preferred it in the early days. And yeah. Matt, I think you know who the people are that I'm talking about. That was kind of what came across, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they referred to kind of, you know, like the mega agencies, right? The ones with the amazing, huge brand awareness and reputation. They'd say, you know, these amazing guys would come in and pitch and we'd absolutely buy into it. We'd love everything they were going to do. And the project started and we never saw them.
Yeah.
Don't fall into that trap, right? You know, people buy people. We really buy into you. It's you we want to deal with.
Yeah, we've definitely. You've been
on the other side of it, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was going to say. I've definitely experienced that, where you, you know, you have chemistry with whoever's pitching and the initial team, and you've all got this clear understanding, and you go through the, you know, you sort of chew your way through all the gristle and the bones, and then you feel like you're a little bit abandoned sometimes, and it isn't that. It's just you know, I know that from the inside point of view, it's putting hands on deck where that needs to be, but it can feel a little bit like you've been left behind or forgotten.
Yeah, and if the company's structured in a way that there's certain people that have to have responsibility to bring in that business, they can't then be the people that are doing and involved in every single project. Yeah. But it's as you say, I think you hit on it perfectly. It's you spend throughout the pitching process, you're spending so long building a relationship with a potential client. And ultimately, they bring you in because they trust you. Fundamentally, they want to do better for their business if they own the business themselves, or better for their career, which is better for the business.
Mm.
And they've got to trust whoever they're working with to help them get to that end goal. So if you're going through that process with them and then they're trusting you more, sharing, you're reassuring them that you understand what their problems are or can potentially see solutions, and then disappear, it is like, whoa, what's happened there? It is a relationship that's all of a sudden broke down.
Yeah, and I think it's good to be clear about that as well, you know, from the start that, you know, your role might be in the new business development, but you'll be working more and more with this team. Otherwise, you can feel a bit catfished.
I think it's important, if that is the structure, isn't it? You've got to make sure the client understands that they... Yeah. This is the people that you're going to be working with, and they're on the journey of us. And we've had it in the past where, you know, don't just bring the new biz team to a pitch, bring the people that are going to do the work.
Yeah.
But that's incredibly hard. You know, on the receiving end of that, you're running a team of people. So when's this project going to land that we're pitching for? Because that depends who I'm going to put on it. So I can bring three people with me, but if it lands in 3 months' time, they might be three different people. So...
Yeah, exactly. And you guys aren't based in London either. Now, I know we always like talk about the significance of being in or out of London, but it is still significant even now. And yeah, there's going to be an expense for an agency to either travel, I suppose, either to or from London or Manchester, whatever. But yeah, if you're taking six people out for a day on a pitch, that's expensive, right?
It's more of the issue of, you take somebody, these are the people that you could work with, but depending on when you want to do the project, they might not be those people. And
on the flip side, we get something. So I do a lot of agency work, and they'll say, Brad, I'm looking for a certain hire. And the amount of times when you start digging deep, they don't actually have the job on. it's dependent on if they win the work.
Yeah.
And that is so strict. Like, if any recruiters are listening, I would definitely start probing in on questions like that of when someone says, oh, we're looking for a designer. And you go, okay, what's the project they're going to be working on? And okay, so if you've got that signed off, and the amount of times it's very like they're not actually hiring, they're just kind of hedging their bets that they may win quite a bit of work.
Line everything up so it can fall into place if they win the project. Yeah.
Happens all the time. All the time.
One other thing I was going to mention, actually, coming out of kind of our design brief and setting up the fuel and kind of designing the outcome, when we were doing our customer research, I think that was really, really strong, which came across before probably we did this, we'd heard it, but basically it became particularly strong when we did this research, which was basically, what is the thing that you guys do that you're really, really good at? Mm. And in our old business, you know what? We really struggled to answer it, right? Because potentially we'd do shampoo bottles, airline seats, consumer electronics, professional equipment. We did digital, we did physical. And I think, you know, like a lot of agencies, right? I think the way you start off often basically down a path that you just grow because work comes along and it's an opportunity to grow the business.
Just take the work.
Yeah, but the chairs. Yeah, we can design chairs, etc. Oh, shampoo bottles. We can do shampoo bottles. And as designers, I think we all think we can take this stuff on. But something that came out really, really clear from this kind of review was that basically, and we kind of deep down, we knew it. But when you kind of, you're in a business which can't change easily, it's very difficult. Whereas starting afresh, actually hearing this real give me focus, right? When I go, I've got X project, I know exactly the people to do this. This was something that came across really, really clear.
Yeah. Go niche. Don't just say you can do everything and really kind of streamline. We are the go-to people for this project.
I think the reason designers or design businesses struggle is to do that. And when you do that, and yeah, we've very much done that, right? Our specialism is consumer electronics, professional electronics. That's it, right? We're not going to find us designing chairs and shampoo bottles in there.
And would you, let's say a lead came in tomorrow from, I don't know, Herman Miller or something. Would you say, look, not for us?
Yeah.
Go and speak to these people, or would you just, because I know a lot of people.
Well, we've already done it. We've had clients that we've, and actually trusted relationships that we worked with previously that they've maybe moved into different jobs, and they come back to us, and they come back to us with going to, oh, we've got this, we need this, can you help us? And we had one, in the last couple of months, Matt, haven't we?
Yeah.
Where it's really, you know, a huge brand, really exciting opportunity. And we have to sit there and go, look, we'd love to do it. We'd love to be involved because it's exciting. But is it actually, can we do it? Do we have the skills to do it properly? No. And therefore, we're not going to say thanks, but no thanks to the client. We then invest the time to go, well, actually, these people could do it for you, make some introductions. Mm. And again, we're not just picking names out of the air. It's like, who do we think from our network could do a good job?
Yeah.
And almost hand it over because, it's
still your reputation in the day. If you were to say, go and talk to these guys, they did a shit job of it, then equally that's going to look bad on you just as much as it's going to look bad on them.
Exactly. Bad on but them. It was in the earlier days, it was hard to say no to stuff. And especially depending on how the business is structured.
Yeah, I'd imagine early on, you're probably thinking about cash flow, and there must have been points where it's like, yeah, Matt, maybe we do need to take that job on because, or was you always confident in your skill set, confident the work's always going to be there?
I think when we started Fuel, there was a level of confidence there. And because I think, Matt, you've touched on this before, if we'd have started the business with this mindset straight out of university or with very little experience, without the confidence to say, no, this is what we do, and we know that we can do this type of work, we've got expertise in this work, and we've got a track record in this work. If we didn't have that kind of backstory with us to be able to sit there and go, oh, no, we're not going to do this because it's not what we want to do, I think we'd have fallen flat on our faces. But with the background that we had, we've been quite fortunate with the fuel to go, no, well, actually, we have the confidence to stick by our guns and know what it is we're going to do. But I think in previous roles, when you're a big organisation with lots of people in the team, you have to take work on with a mindset of what's the best for the whole business. Whereas that's not how we're structured now, so we can be quite choosy.
Yeah. So we,
and we being choosy about picking the work that we know we can do a good job on, not do we or don't we want to work on it.
So what would you recommend then for people that were thinking about building an agency? Would you say go niche or actually take on that variety and then from that hone in what you're good at?
I think you should go niche.
That's what Mel said, didn't she, Jerome? Just trying to think. She said, I think we asked her at Canada 4, we said, would you hire a specialist or a generalist? And she said specialist every time.
I think it's, you know, and it just comes back to what I mentioned earlier. Clients ask you, what are you good at? Oh, I'm good at everything. I can do packaging, I can do UI, I can do industrial products. Well, mate, can you really?
Well, we had a good analogy, didn't we, for this, which is like elite sportsman, right? You might be an elite sportsman, right? You're good at that sport. And I think the example I used was Bradley Wiggins finished being an amazing cyclist on everything. Yeah. He thought, you know what, I can change to basically be an Olympic rower. Next Olympics, I'm Tokyo, wherever, I'm coming back as a rower. And he couldn't. And he couldn't get through the trials, right? And I think it's similar with designers. I think, you know, everyone deep down knows probably what they're good at. And there's many, many, many things you can be good at, right? And I'm not just talking about the kind of objects you design, but your skill set, etc. And I think it's really easy to go, oh, yeah, I could just do that. You know, I could do that. It's similar to what I do, yeah? And I'm sure Bradley Wiggins thought the same. It's similar. It's big high output, you know, power job, cardio, etc. But the reality is that basically, you know, once you've been working for a while, you should know where you play, right? You should know where you fit. And I think to try and, you know, if you make, like Jim says, if you make that transition of like, yeah, I could do a bit of that, I could do a bit of this, like, you're not going to be as good as a specialist.
Mm. And
you're never justify the fees either.
Yeah. Well, you are. It's like, can you compare with someone who, an agency that does that and that's what they do day in, day out? Are you going to be as creative, efficient? Probably not, because you haven't got the level of expertise. Mm. And then the other thing as well is like, you get, if you push people that are working for you on projects into working on things that are out their comfort zone, you're not going to get as good result out of them because it's not what they want to do.
I suppose as well, when you've got experience in one area, there are things that spring to your mind from memory that you've worked on that are similar, but they're still within your niche and you've got the same sort of applicable set of problems. I'm thinking of one in particular that I can't say anything about, but you know, you do. Yeah. So if you're going
to, want me to edit this in 6 months later or something,
but even if it's somewhat analogous, but it's still within the same industry or maybe it's the same skill set or something like that, then yeah, you get that little bit of a trigger of I've hit this problem before and I know how to solve it. Whereas if you're not used to that, you're still going to carry on in something that ultimately will undermine you a little bit later on.
The problem is like what happens when the niche bottles out? That's the problem. What happens if all of the certain companies that you work with just turn around and said, actually, market's died for this kind of thing? So it's that balance, isn't it, we're saying going niche, but actually what happens if you're an expert in something that doesn't make any money?
You could be an expert in pivoting.
How tight is that niche, isn't it? I mean, it's, we would say that we design consumer electronics, but
it's broad, you know.
Yeah, it is. But there's not many agencies that will ID firms that will be specific into that. There'll be ID firms that say they do industrial design, and it is, you know, as Matt says, from shampoo bottles to airline seats and absolutely every medical, everything in there. And that's massively broad, whereas we are still relatively broad, but we brought it in so that we know our expertise can kind of stretch left and right a little bit. But as you say, it's not like we're saying our expertise is SLR cameras and then, no one wants an SLR camera anymore. Yeah, what are we going to do?
But James also got a good example, sorry, Brad, from when he basically looked after the staff in our old business, about when you're broad, which we were before, that he never had the right person for the right job, despite having everybody with lots of different skill sets. It was like timing, wasn't it, Jim, about how the way projects come in?
Yeah, it is. It's like, you've got people that, you don't want to put people out of their comfort zones. It's like, okay, so yeah, everyone can design stuff relatively well, but actually you're going to make me do a shampoo bottle. It's not really what I want to do. So
it's not the reason why I signed up for the job either.
Yeah, exactly. So you're just going to piss your team off as well, because that's not what their passion is necessarily.
Mm. One thing I just wanted to, I think we're coming up for like, it's one of these where I knew this one would be when I'd look at the time, and it's like 45 minutes afterwards and it feels like 2 minutes. But we spoke last week and you touched upon Instagram, Matt, as like a strategy of like, this is something we're going to pay quite close attention to in terms of when you're building out the fuel.
Yeah.
What was the reason behind it? Because it was almost like it was, because you're very good at playing the Instagram game with the beautiful kind of renders and stuff, but it's like that was like a key pillar of the strategy of building out the fuel in.
Yeah, part of our audit, what we found is that actually there is just like a million design companies, right? Every day we looked, we would find a design company that we'd never heard of. Yeah. And I'm not just talking, you know, in different countries. I'm talking like, here's another UK one. Oh, no, they've been going 3 years, never heard of them. And, you know, we thought that we knew the design, industrial design industry, especially in the UK, quite well. And this was just surprising. It's like, God, there's another one. And
yeah, I see one swap up all the time. That's an interesting product or something. Whereas, and you look at the people that work there and you go, oh, I know someone that used to work with that person. And but even when you think you know everyone, something just pops out of nowhere. Some startups won a boatload of money or something. And you go, oh, like there's a link there. Even though you think it's a small world, sometimes it isn't. Sometimes just things coming up all the time, isn't there?
Sure. So as part of this, kind of like you say, as a strategy, we said, look, we have to basically get our name out there, right? We have to basically do this. But at the same time, anyone in design knows that basically if you're going to work on real products that are going to make it to manufacture, you're not going to show something for at least a year. Mm. And you know, we've got products that we did way back, haven't we, Jim, which still haven't come out, right? Which have been going on a couple of years, yeah? And that's frustrating because you're like, people want to see what we're doing. How are we going to make a name for ourselves? How are we going to basically be seen? And what we decided, and I say it was a strategy, is that we would basically start using Instagram to basically share our inspiration. Now, I know some people might not agree with it, but ultimately designers love Pinterest, right? I'm sure every designer goes on Pinterest and goes, oh, lovely images, like. Now, the thing, and I've fallen into this, right? The thing about that is it's almost instantaneous, okay? You don't know what that object is half the time. You don't know who did it, you know, what agency, what in-house team was behind it. And what I felt by basically starting to do the Instagram was that we could possibly build a following because people like what we like, right? But I also could make it informative. I could make it basically almost like a bit of a reference, if you like, in terms of we only do consumer electronics, so you'll only ever find consumer electronics on there. But what I'd always do is I'd find out who did the work. I'd find out about it. You know, has it won an award? You know, was it done by the in-house team? Ideally, it's done by people that I can actually name by name. Mm. And the thing that I find now is it's really insightful. So I actually feel, despite being an industrial design agency in industry for a long, long time, I actually feel that I'm more aware of people doing good work now and who they are and what they did and those objects, which you might have seen on Pinterest loads, but actually I can tell you what it is and why they did it possibly or the project behind it. So it's come kind of like a bit of a side project, but obviously what it's done, and you mentioned this, Brad, is, you know, we've got like 18,500 followers now, and we're slowly now able to drip feed a bit of our own work into that, which is obviously the...
I saw the Vodafone stuff, which was, I think I jokingly said, did you just do the digital stuff or something like that? But there are kind of little bits that pop up of the fuels work.
Yeah, and you know, that's obviously the ideal, is that as more work gets through to production and we can talk about it, we will obviously use that as a platform to also share our own work. But no, there's no priority between basically sharing the inspiration work and sharing our own work.
Yeah, but and Jim, you said you won a client based on the pins he was liking.
Yeah, well, no, that was years ago, wasn't it? We got a client who shortlisted us for project pitching. I can't remember if we won it in the end. I'm not sure, Matt. Can you remember? That was because they followed our Pinterest boards and liked what we were pinning. Yeah, they shortlisted them on that one. Yeah,
when actually, and the Instagrams had that as well, Brad. So we have actually had people who've come to us and said, basically, similarly, like, you know, I like the kind of stuff that you guys are basically putting on the Instagram. They understand that basically it's not ours. And likewise, we've got clients who perhaps wouldn't follow design in any other way on Instagram, who started following us and actually going, actually, it's good. You know, you're giving me awareness. You let me see all this other stuff that's going on.
That's the thing. I think it's a really nice opportunity to start a conversation with non-design professionals or people who are not even really au fait with what we're talking about half the time. But to be able to say, look, this little detail here makes all the difference, you know, just point something out and get that little spark of interest.
Yeah. Well, it comes back to that recommendation and expertise again as well for us, because it was like, who clients, it's very rare that you're going to get cold called by a client to do something. It's about someone, typically referral, or typically people you've already worked with, or maybe someone getting referred. So it's how can we be found? And an Instagram follower with 18,500 makes a hell of a lot more impact than an Instagram account with 600 people on there. But equally within the industry, it was about trying to get our name known a bit more so that if someone's, you know, we've been put in that situation, oh guys, I need to do a project on X, Y, Z. I know it's not your specialism, but could you recommend anyone? And
it's like you're that thought leader.
Yeah, just trying to put ourselves in a position that we're known within the industry a bit more than if we were just started 3 years ago and we're not. External exposure.
Yeah, I had a situation a couple of months back where I had I won't name who it is because he'd lynch me, but basically he was working for a startup company and he left and I just dropped him a message saying, what happened? You know, you weren't there for that long. And he said, Brad, the owner of the company turned around and said he only wanted to use design agencies that had a big Instagram following. And that was the prerequisite of who he would want to work with. And so that may not have been part of your thinking all those years ago, but actually it's like there's a return of investment that can come off. Now, we'll share your work to these 20,000 people and hopefully 5 of them buy the product. So it's that kind of something. But it's remarkable, isn't it? Because you wouldn't have thought that kind of, and you wonder where that could go. Or where that
as an in-houser, thinking like when you're trying to get a new agency on the approved suppliers list, are they 13485 accredited? How many Instagram followers have they got? Will they accept 30 days
terms? Do they listen to Design Truth? Yes.
Yeah. It sounds like madness. I mean, I guess it might be a soft rule, but I can't imagine that being we live in crazy times.
What's interesting is some designers, only a few, find it very hard to believe that we're willing to show other people's work and give them credit.
Well, that's the industry through and through, though, isn't it? It's like you can't say anything positive about competition because you're going to lose all your clients. It's like, oh, bollocks, isn't it?
Oh, I don't get do you think
that's
that.
Do you think that's still as prevalent? This brings me back to the one question I've been wanting to throw at you guys. Like, what's the difference in the culture now from when you guys came in to now? I've thrown two questions at you at the same time. Really. But
I think that is probably, and that hence why I led that question, which is I think there was, I don't know whether that was necessarily the case, but I think when we started in the industry, it never seemed like there was any, I don't say love, but that's the wrong word, respect for other agencies. The other agencies that if you worked in agency one,
they all hated each other.
And shit. Every project they did, crap. it's just all bollocks. Whereas I don't think that is the case anymore. I think there still is out there, but not as much as it used to. But I still think, you know, we've got miles to get better. I think as an industry in ID, we still all hate to think that there's competition out there and that we can have a civil relationship with our competitors.
Yeah. You wonder, Drew, like if we were to do this 5 years ago, would there have been a similar kind of take up, something like this? I'm referring to the podcast.
Yeah, I would expect probably a no. Five, definitely 10. Five things started to, I think, isn't that long ago, but global conversations have been more about respect over the last few years and about.
But I think it's going to keep going that way. I think if you ever spend time talking to junior designers, for example, they're always in this quest for like community or just collaboration, but isn't necessarily etched in people that are over a certain age.
I think it's not just design. I think you look at, there's generational shifts.
That's a wider thing. It's not just a design thing. Yeah.
But there again, as well, I suppose if you're looking at, I was going to say 20 years ago, but let's go further back than that. Like, let's go, let's just go further back than that. Not be too specific. There might not have been, I mean, realistically, there probably weren't as many designers and there weren't as many companies looking for designers.
And there wasn't as much information out there in, because there are still agencies where I look at it and I'll use like four people, for example, and I go, what do they actually do? Still to this day, 2021, I don't know the work that they're actually working on. It's still quite secret squirrel. Whereas 20 years ago or whatever, I'd imagine that you would have not known any work any of the agencies would ever done, because the information is just not openly out there.
Well, it was Design Week, wasn't it? Every Thursday, you get your Design Week into the studio and then, oh, we've got some work in there. Cool, great. Or, I remember when certain agencies would run big ads on the back page and it's, oh, they're obviously doing well. And that was how you knew about agencies and what they were doing. But again, you'd see their work, oh shit, that's crap. What were you judging on? It's just, do I like the look of it? You never knew what the brief was. You never know what they were trying to solve or do for their client.
I just wanted to wrap this up with two listener questions, two quick questions for you both. They were quite good ones, so I thought I'd share it with you. Maybe a case of just like the first thing that kind of comes to your head type thing. But one question was from Tom Parsons, Tom, that we had on.
We know Tom.
Ether. And he just said, strangest brief you've ever been given.
So I think, I know which one I'm going to do for this. So basically, we were working for an incredibly large Korean consumer electronics company, which you may be able to guess. basically, we've done quite a few projects for them, and they've been design-led innovation projects, which were fairly difficult but straightforward. And all of a sudden, there came this new brief. And basically, the brief was, we need to innovate in consumer electronics in kitchen appliances. Okay, straightforward that bit. However, we've just acquired a factory in Poland. It's massively underused. And basically, your innovation must be innovating for this factory. So whatever the factory does, your innovation has to basically be based around the factory's capabilities. So it's kind of like starting backwards. So we've got ourselves a factory, what are we going to design? And that was a very strange brief, because we ended up starting off with a workshop, which really was helping the Samsung team understand how do you basically get something that's truly innovative, that's resonating with customers, that people are going to pay for, that ultimately isn't some new process. So, we're going to have to adapt or modify what the factory does to basically create this innovation. And to kind of cut a very long story short, it's a long project. We actually had two really, really great projects come off the back of it. So we had something called Virtual Flame, which is basically induction hobs. I don't know if you're familiar with those, typical black slabs of glass. We actually created this thing, which was basically projected LED illumination. So actually you see the heat, you can control it in a traditional gas way. And we also had this product called the Dual Flex Oven, which basically is an oven which splits in two, and you can open it a bit like the Range Rover door was, or boot was, how it's described. You can open the door in two different ways to understand that you can use it in one oven or two. And that actually came out of this innovating kind of from the factory point of view, thinking like a factory manager.
Oh, vertical integration.
Yeah. Nice. What about you, Jim? Any spring to mind from over the years?
Strangest project. I think one of the strangest ones I did was for BAE Systems, actually. And they wanted to use ID to get graduate engineers to join their company because everyone was joining F1 teams. So it was working, basically trying to do concept work within weapons systems, ironically enough, and make it look sexy and appealing so that young grads could not be drawn across to F1 teams and could go and join part of BAE Systems. That was nothing I thought I'd be doing as part of my career. It was probably about 10 years ago now, but that was a strange one.
Jim, I remember you came back from a meeting and you'd been to see a load of the troops, and you said to, I think this is on a paraphrase now, you were like, they love the fact that on their PlayStation or Xbox, they're brilliant. They're basically getting everyone. They're brilliant shot, amazing. But when they use these real weapons, they're terrible.
Yeah. There was some insightful things in that project, that's for sure. It was a different one. That's a weird one.
Yeah, I like that question. So I think what I'm going to do, Tom, is I'm going to steal that for every guest. I think we can we'll wrap up every episode asking that question, really. So I'm going to steal that, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
And we're actually coming up for a year, Drew. Did you know that?
Yeah, a lot of things are coming up for a year right now, aren't they?
Bro? Yeah. Next month is a year. When we started, and I actually dropped a message to Matt and Will that we did the first one with, and they were saying we should do some sort of year get together or something like that. So I'll see what I can.
Yeah, it would be nice to do end of the first year kind of wrap party with with anyone who, you know, open invitation to a mass Zoom for any one of the guests.
Well, hopefully, not Zoom, right? One day you actually meet in person.
Absolutely, that's the goal.
That's the plan.
And well done for you guys as well for doing this as well. Bringing, as we said, like trying to get everyone within the industry a bit more open and sharing stuff. It's sounds obvious, but and I'm sure everyone's talked about trying to do it, but no one's been doing it. So good on you guys as well for bringing it all together. It's you're doing a good job.
Definitely.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it.
Still haven't had anyone say they hate it. So maybe that means that
one's listened to us talk today. That's the thing. This one goes live.
It's weird. I talk to my my old boss, Paul, that I rope in some of these sometimes, and he talks about I was actually on a call with him the other day, and it's like people that he's talking to on like the other side of the planet. And like every person he now talks to, they always say, "Oh, I listened to you on the podcast the other day." It's really weird. It's like I probably get more messages than you do, but you get the odd message, don't you? And it's like, "Hi, I'm from like Poland or something." It's like, I've listened to that. Great.
But, it is super nice when you get a little bit of feedback like that. It really cheers you up, because you know you're not always thinking about the podcast, and especially like up until recently, having had quite a tough start to the year professionally, and then. Yeah, like people have sort of reached out after the one-on-one that we had at the start of the year, where we had a bit of a moan. Yeah, that's been really nice, and yeah, it does mean a lot to us. And the thing is, I just can't believe it doesn't already exist, because it's so easy.
But it doesn't. Like, it doesn't cost a lot either. It doesn't take much time. It does a little bit.
The thing is, I think it's like we said earlier. The reason that this exists is because people are nice to each other. Like we ask people, hey, would you mind coming on our, like, we've got this little project. Would you like to come and join us and just hang out for an hour? And people want to do it. Mm. So it is amazing how just nice people are if you allow them to be.
Yeah. It's great to see the rivalry as well that we spoke about earlier, right? This thing of screw you, like you're a competitor. I'm not talking to you.
We haven't invited Dick Powell on yet, so maybe I have to edit that bit out. Thanks guys, and we will catch up all for a beer, I'm sure.
Thank you for listening to episode 20 of Design Truth. We don't actually have an episode 21 booked in just yet. A few things bubbling away internally, and hopefully I'll be able to tell you all about the next phase of Design Truth come April. Maybe you can even guess what it is. More importantly, look after yourselves. If you did like the episode, then always just track us down. Stalk us on social media. Let us know your opinion, positive or negative. Thankfully, they are mainly positive, but you know, feel free to chip in and give us your thoughts. 1 month away from the beer gardens in the UK. So stay strong, everyone, and we'll see you next time.